It's time to talk fishing here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio in the North Woods of Wisconsin and the Northern Lakes of Wisconsin and also the World Championship Muskie Classic. Larry Mueller here, really pleased to be in Manitouish Waters at the Manitouish Waters Community Center with a nice crowd out here. Hi, everybody. All right. Glad to have that crowd of people here and glad to have you listening in because we got a great show today. We're going to talk about the World Muskie Classic, the championship, with Bill Shearer, who is the founder of the World Championship Muskie Classic. He's a board member. Leo Crawley has fished that classic. It's been going for 31 years. Guess how many years he's been fishing it? 31. And so he's going to give us some insight, as is Joe Bucher of Eagle River, Wisconsin. Joe has I'm envious of him a little bit. He has 5 line class world records fish. He was inducted into the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame as a legendary angler. I'm a charter member of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, but unfortunately, I haven't been designated as a legendary angler. Not many people get to have that designation. Anyway, he also, of course, has his own show, Fishing, a television show, Fishing with Joe Bucher. He's a blues guitarist. He does a whole lot of things, and really happy to have him along to share what he knows about fishing. And we're going to zero in today on muskies a little bit, but we'll also be talking about fishing of all types. I should also mention that Joe has manufactures and makes a lot of lures, and I know I have... Welcome, by the way, Joe. I know you. I have some depth raiders and some shallow raiders and some Bucher tails in my tackle box.
Well, we appreciate that very much.
Thanks a lot for being with us today. Leo Crawley, thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
You look pretty young for fishing 31 years in this contest. I would have thought that would have aged you a little bit.
Well, the experience actually is what keeps me young.
Bill Shearer, I'm really pleased to have Bill with us because Bill founded this classic those 31 years ago. He's still a board member. Bill Shearer, pleasure to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You know, let's talk first. I just want to talk about fishing in general and maybe musky fishing and get your reactions on this. What is the allure of musky fishing for you guys? Joe, what's the allure for you?
You know, I've tried to explain it to so many people, and it's hard to explain because it's musky hunting. You know, it's not really musky fishing. When you fish for something else, you expect to catch something. In fact, you expect to catch a lot, and if you don't, it hasn't been a good day. But if you get a couple follows or get a couple strikes, sometimes you can consider that an okay musky day, which doesn't really rank when you compare it to other fish species. So, you know, it's really musky hunting. Mm-hmm. And the allure, what really lures me to muskie fishing more than anything else is the fact that you're fishing a body of water where you could have a fish follow in or strike, or you could even catch one that's almost as big as you.
Yeah.
You know, and where all the other fish you're fishing for, you know, a largemouth bass, if you catch a big largemouth bass up here, it's a 5-6 pound fish.
Yeah.
A walleye would be 8 to 10 pounds. When you're talking muskies, you know, you're talking the top end on the muskie thing around here. Well, I mean, Wisconsin's still, you know, the home of the world record, which was, you know, over 5 feet long. Yeah. So, you know, that's what lures me to muskies. The fact that at any one of these lakes up here, you can be just drifting around out here, and all of a sudden you raise something that literally puts you on your knees.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill Shearer, you founded the World Championship Muskie Classic. What is the allure for you, and also talk a little bit about how you got this classic started?
Well, I think anybody that's ever fished for a muskie, there's a great allure, but just in that thought itself. And the fact that you're going out, as Joe said, and put your talents against the fish, and always remember that the fish is trying to get away from you as hard as you are trying to catch it, and things work out pretty good in that situation. Well, the muskie classic really started in the halls of Congress. Believe it or not, because Congress some years ago realized that the small towns and communities did not have access to gaining much money to run that small town and community. They needed to have fire trucks. They needed to have improvement of educational facilities. They needed a great many things. So Congress took it upon themselves to go ahead and do these kinds of things for the people with allotments or grant money, as we were called it in those days, or startup funds. And they worked it through the educational program. Well, we picked that up out at school and took it to the board of our board, and they looked at it and said yes, because they were looking at another prospect, and that other prospect was to try to do something for the economy of this area. Because as of today, the North, 30-some years ago, shut down. There was nothing going on. Mm-hmm. The resorts weren't open. You couldn't find a you had to go a far distance to find a restaurant that was around that was open. And so the board saw those kinds of things that were needed in our area. And so it started at that particular time. They told me to go out and hire someone, which we did. It was Ken Ranicki. And I recall the first day that after I interviewed Ken, came in, Ken, I've got Ren, my neighbor, mixed up here. And he and I talked for one whole day, the whole day. We didn't realize we missed lunch. Right on through, outlining what could happen for a community. And it did happen. And it was taken care of all those kind of items for our board. They had a general meeting, and everybody was surprised that the number of people that showed up for that meeting. And there were people like you, who are people out there now, probably some of you have done these things, that really went and gave the muscle work to the organization. And it worked in that capacity, and has ever since. One of the things that was ardent in the program and thinking of the boards and the people on the Muskie board now, was elected that very night, they said that we have to keep a differentiation between business and school. We don't want to be involved with any organization that would like to take a part of this. We want this in the hands of the school mm-hmm. and the people of the community. And so it was in the hands of the school, then it went in the hands of the community, which it should be.
And over the years, you've managed to raise something like $100,000, if I'm not mistaken, for scholarships, local scholarships, and other local things for local people here in the whole Presque Isle, Manitowish Waters, Boulder Junction, and in this area of the state. And you're really to be commended for doing that. We'll talk some more about that. I want to bring Leo into the show. Leo, you got started in the 31 years ago in this world championship. You must have had some great times fishing over 31 years in this classic.
Well, I did. I happened to sit on the board of directors of Bill's Muskie Club at the time that the formation was going on up here 31 years ago. They did give us a call, asked Bill's Muskie Club what their opinion of a muskie tournament was. How would you run it? Or what would you do? Being a board member, and we hashed it over for probably 45 minutes or so, come to the conclusion that we didn't want to put a price on our fish. Mm-hmm. We wanted to protect that fish as much as possible. We recommended that they do trophy so that you would get the esteem of your fellow fishermen, and it worked out beautifully.
Well, it sure has, and there have been a lot of fish caught over the years, and I think and released as well, as you were talking about. I think somebody was telling me earlier that it's like 96 or 98% of all the fish that are caught in the tournament are actually released back to the water, so they're back there for other folks to catch.
Well, if you stop, and pardon to interrupt, but if you stop and think about it, catch and release was part of this tournament. It didn't start that way. They used to have a fish truck that came around. If you caught a fish, they put it in the truck. It was a freezer truck. We killed a lot of fish to start with, but it evolved, as did the sport itself, into catch and release, and it's beautiful. And tournaments like this promotes that.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join us. If you have a question or comment for any of our guests here as we talk this Muskie Championship and we also talk fishing, we can talk about lake quality, we can talk about great things that are happening and maybe some issues that need to be addressed as well. I know our guys are up on many of those. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. with your questions and comments. And I would again invite folks from the audience, if you have some questions and you want to join in and ask a question of our guests, you're welcome to do that. As a matter of fact, Ray from Manitouish Waters, who's actually going to be my fishing buddy, I think, here for the next few days, Ray Palmonis, has a question. Ray, what's your question?
Well, I've been listening to public radio for many, many years. I read Muskie Hunter. I got some of Joe's videos. And at one time, I was a taxidermist, so I know a muskie's brain is just a little smaller than the tip of my finger. So
about
why
the size
can't
of a pea.
My massive brain fool that little one?
Oh, that's a
what
joke.
Do I need to know that I don't know now?
Joe, I'll turn to you for that one.
Well, I'll tell you. I can tell you in all honesty that, you know, of course, I'm supposed to be one of the best in the business, and I can tell you when it comes to muskies, they humble me every day I'm out there, every week I'm out there. When you're trying to film a television show for them, it's even, why aren't there many guys filming muskies on television? Because they're too hard to catch, and they lose money trying to film them. There is no secret to, you know, there's no secret lake out there. There's no magic formula. The only advice I give people all the time in muskie fishing is, it's not only the harder you work, the luckier you get, but the more you learn, the luckier you get. One of the best advice I always give muskie fishermen is that practice your skills. You know, the better you are at doing, at performing, casting, retrieving, figurating, working a variety of lures, the better you are at it, the more chance you're going to have at catching muskies. And one of the big drawbacks to muskie fishing is that the fish are so hard to catch in general. And then you compound that with getting a lot of backlashes, you know, not knowing what lures to fish in what situations, so you're getting a lot of weeds on your lures. And I see a lot of people out there nodding or giggling. It happens to all of us, but I mean, what I'm getting at is the more proficient you can be per cast, per hour, per day, the more muskies you will probably catch. And that, you know, it becomes an odds game. It's a tough game anyway. It's a fish of 10,000 casts, so to speak. But it can be the fish of 100,000 casts. It can be, if you don't do it right. If you do everything right, it's still tough. And the one day when it's easy, when it's comparatively easy, when you catch two or three of them, or get lucky and catch more than that, you more than make up for that with some bad days, you know. So it all equals out. The fish is never really easy. And with all of the anglers that are out there today fishing for them, even though we're, you know, like Leo said, you know, it's really evolved into almost entirely a catch and release sport, which is wonderful. But even with all that said and done, there's so much fishing pressure today. There's so many more anglers through Muskie Hunter magazine and through the educational things that we have today. We've taught so many more muskie anglers how to fish for them. I'm not saying how to catch them, but how to fish for them. So instead of having one or two guys on a lake like we did 15, 20 years ago when I was in Boulder Junction up here guiding years ago, now we have, you know, on a weekend like this, you could have 150 anglers on a body of water, you know, especially when you have a tournament going. But so that compounds the problem too, because the fish are seeing a lot more lures, and you just have to be a little bit better at it than the next guy. And of course, like all fishing, there's always an element of luck, and that's what brings us all out there to sit in a deer stand on a cold winter's day. Because anybody who's sitting there, you know, that's another thing I've always told my customers when I was still guiding this, is just, you got to remember this: if you do everything right and you're making good casts and retrieves and figurates and all that kind of stuff, just remember this: that when you make that cast out there and that bait hits the water, the fish out there does not take a resume before he strikes. So that fish has no idea that you've never caught a muskie before, or that you've caught all kinds of muskie before. Fish has no idea. So if you make the right cast at the right time and you're doing things somewhat correctly, you could hit one out of the park and be the next world record holder, right?
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Let's hope. We're talking today with Bill Scherer, who is founder of the World Championship Muskie Classic, a board member. Leo Crowley has fished the Classic all 31 years. And well-known fisherman, television personality, lure manufacturer, and a whole lot of other things as well. Great musician, too. Joe Buchert with us today. I'm Larry Mueller. Carmen Jackson on the phones today. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're broadcasting from Manitouish Waters, from the Manitouish Waters Community Center. I'm Larry Mueller, really pleased to be with you today to talk, and with this great crowd, to talk about fishing in Wisconsin, especially in northern Wisconsin. We're zeroing in a little bit on muskies today, but we'll talk about fishing, other kinds of fish as well. Certainly, if you have questions maybe about the World Championship Muskie Classic, as I said earlier, it's still time. You can come on up and participate and sign up, and I think through Saturday noon, I believe, is the last of the sign-up time for the tournament this weekend. You can do that as well. We'll learn some more about how to do that, too. And if you have some questions about fish or about the water up here or the lake levels, we can talk a bit about that, too. We can talk about some of the invasive species, perhaps, that may potentially, and some realistically, are already presenting some problems in the lakes, and how we're trying to address those as well with our guests. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments, and we would be glad to get you on the air. And Bill Shearer, there, as I said, there is still time to sign up for the contest and get involved in it right up through noon on Saturday.
That's correct. There'll be somebody here at this site in Manitouish Waters, which is a municipal building, right on Highway 51. If you come and know where you're going but haven't signed up, you can just go into the crowd and you'll find somebody there who will direct you to at a table where to go, how to go, fill out your forms and things such as that.
And it's, what is it, the entry fee is?
It's $25 normally if you went before, I think, September 1st. But after that time, it's additional $10.
And the nice thing about it is that all the money goes to support the local community and especially the children and scholarships. And that's a great thing. Bill in Hazelhurst has a question, and I'll tell you what, we're going to get that question. Jane Richter is running around right now with a microphone, chasing through the audience to get to Bill. Bill in Hazelhurst.
Hello, I'm Bill, and nice to see you all here. My question is pretty dry in the North Woods. Been dry for the last 2 to 3 years. So what effect does this have on the overall fishing? The lakes are therefore smaller or less circumference. Does that make it, are they more bunched together or what? What's the influence of the drought that we're having?
Okay, and let's go to Leo first for that. We'll get input from most of our guys here.
Well, I happen to work at a bait shop in Presque Isle, and the reports that are coming in off the lakes is everything's very, very low. The boat landings are very, very shallow. So if you got a big boat and you're going into one of the smaller lakes, you're in trouble. But my suggestion is hit Presque Isle or something like that that's got a lot deeper boat landing. But for right now, you got to go deeper. The fish are on the deep weed edge. You need some green weeds. Don't be fishing anything that's brown because it's not going to work. Another thing that you want to be paying attention to is the lakes are gin clear. We have had no runoff. There's nothing to cloud up the waters at all. So the very bright stuff is going to work. I think silver is just the color to be this weekend. So, but that's my opinion. But that's what's going on out there. The lakes are shallow and they're very clear.
Yeah, and Joe, you want to chime in on that as well?
Well, it's interesting because when you get a situation like this, it is unusual. And, yeah, and even putting your boat in the water is sometimes a chore. And I think if any of us have fished at all this, even the last couple of weeks, you see, I've been filming a couple of television shows up here the last week and a half or so. And boy, I tell you, just getting your boat in and out of the water on landings where you've never had a problem before, you're having all kinds of problems. So that's an issue in itself. One of the other issues, like Leo says, you have some clear water, and the water's clearer than normal because you don't have much runoff. The other thing is that you have weed growth that generally may have 6 inches to maybe 2 feet of water above that weed growth this time of the year. All that weed growth, because of the low water, a lot of that weed growth is actually on the surface and folded over. we're making a lot of those weed beds just solid mats, you know, where they're almost impenetrable. And so, you know, presentations are different. There are fish up inside some of that stuff, but getting at them is like almost like slop bass fishing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're fishing a really, the shallow water fish, the classic musky classic weed pattern that would be so big this time of the year where you're drifting across a weed bed on any given lake in any given time of the year. This year it's different because that weed bed is on the surface and it's double thick. And then you add Eurasian milfoil to that equation, which we seems to be growing rapidly with this low stagnant water. So even some of our little rivers, our little river systems, if you drive by them, you can see they're just a solid mat of milfoil. And it's teaching a lot of us how to fish again. We have to fish differently. In some ways, modified bass tactics have become real popular because the guys who are fishing shallow are getting way up inside that stuff and fishing with weedless spoons and spinner baits, single hook lures, stuff like that. I would definitely recommend to anglers out there fishing this weekend is not only fish deep, but also fish single hook lures like spinner baits, stuff like that, and get up inside the stuff and, you know, short machine gun type casting, get up and tight inside some of this heavy cover because it's going to be thick. And lastly, I think that open water fishing has a lot of validity this year. What happens a lot of times when the water gets real low is the fish instinctively move in. They move out of the perimeter and start moving towards the center. And when that happens, these fish a lot of times will just be, especially in small lakes, they will actually be roaming around over open water in the middle of the lake.
One thing I've noticed, a lot of the fishermen now at the landings have their hip boots with them, so they can push the boat back up in a place to pull it on the trailer.
The other thing I've been hearing is some of the mid-lake bars, the humps that are out there, are starting to hold quite a few muskies.
And I believe Bill had a follow-up question as well, so let's let him have that follow-up too.
This is Bill again. And my next question would be propagation of the muskie. And along with that, in the Woodruff fish hatchery, the ponds are all empty. Not quite sure what happened or what's going on.
And we may not be sure of that either. I'm not sure of that. Maybe somebody who's listening in can call and help us out with that question. Give us a call if you got an answer to that at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call and see what you can come up with for an answer to that particular question about the muskie propagation and the work that's going on with that. We'd appreciate that as well. And I think we've
Larry?
Got... Yeah, go ahead.
Bill, maybe you want to give Steve Gilbert a call down there. He's a fish manager for this area. He would give you an answer.
The very good suggestion. Tony in Boulder Junction has a question for us. Tony?
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I would like your opinion on how much you decrease your chances of taking a muskie by using a fly rod.
You know, I have a really good friend who's fishes muskie a lot with a fly rod and enjoys it a lot. Joe, have you ever tried fishing with a fly rod for muskie?
I have not. but the guy sitting right next to me, his son even has a specialty fly shop, so I think he's very qualified to answer this question.
Bill Shearer?
I think you see more fish. I really do. Because we don't get tied up in the weeds as much as you do with an exposed hook because we put a guard on top of the hook, you know, and we only have one hook, and that's a difficulty because if you get a big fish, it's really hard to get that hook into that bone. We usually sharpen our hooks every 20 minutes so that we can keep them good and sharp. Mm-hmm. But the fellas do quite well.
And how do you sharpen your hooks?
File, small file like this, and draw away down to the bend.
I'll give you a little tip, a thing that I use and anybody else. A very inexpensive thing to do is to buy an ignition file. go to a store that deals with auto parts and so forth, and you buy a little ignition file and wrap a little tape around the end of it, and the ignition files really do a nice job of sharpening hooks.
Good.
Something that I learned a long time back, and I usually keep a couple extra along with me in the tackle box and hand them out to people that I might be fishing with that might not have that hook sharpener with them. Well, I tell you what, we've got some more. We've got a caller online. Let's go to Patty in Pewaukee next. Patty, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for. I was so excited to hear that you had a muskie show on. I live on Pewaukee Lake, fortunate enough to be on a great muskie lake. And the big question we have there is, we have a lot of water, obviously, on the lake. It's actually a no wake zone right now. But the question I have, and the big question in the village of Pewaukee, is the milfoil. We have terrible milfoil on Pewaukee Lake. And they're talking a lot about just dropping pellets and, herbicides on it to eliminate that. What effect does that have on the muskie and the fish?
Okay, what effect does the addition of herbicides, essentially what we're talking about, herbicides to the water, what effect does that have on the fish? Or are you asking about the milfoil?
We have terrible milfoil. Pewaukee's been kind of renowned for the milfoil, and right now it is folding over, like he's saying. But we've had just huge city council meetings on these dropping of pellets, and there's a lot of, argument. A lot of us live in the lake. Besides being musky fish, a lot of us actually swim in it every day. So just trying to figure out what kind of effect that has on the fish when you do a kind of a cover over the whole lake of herbicides and the pellets.
That's probably a question that we may not be able to answer. We may have some opinions here. Anybody want to try an opinion on it, Joe?
I can address it from a fisherman's standpoint, in that when the milfoil starts, when they do any kind of commercial spraying of weeds of any kind, you will see first of all, milfoil, muskies like the milfoil. It's muskie anglers that don't like the milfoil. Muskies do like the milfoil, so when that milfoil is good and thick like that, they've just got more places to hide. And when you're looking out at that milfoil, and we're having that milfoil problem up here too. You can see it growing in the lake, and so it's really, in my opinion, fishing these lakes as many years as I have. And by the way, I did fish the first Muskie Classic.
did.
I did. I'm a former Boulder Junction resident. In fact, my son went to school up here when he was in grade school. but anyways, getting in this milfoil thing. What I'm seeing the milfoil do is actually choke out all of the native species of plants up here. The cabbage weeds and many of the things that we grew up fishing on some of those lakes. If you haven't fished a lake in about 10, 15 years and you come back and you fish a lake today, that same lake that you knew well 10, 15 years ago, you'd be amazed when you put your boat in the water. You go to a spot where you saw a big cabbage weed bed, and all of a sudden there isn't any cabbage there. It's all milfoil. The other thing milfoil does is it grows deeper than those other weeds. It's just so prolific. Where you might have had a weed line 15 years ago that was 5-6 feet on a stained water lake, for example. That was cabbage. Now you'll have a weed line in a lot of cases 8, 9, 10 feet deep that's all milfoil growing all over the surface. And so it really does complicate the whole fishing situation. When they do spray it, I do have some experience with that. That goes way back to my boyhood years. And what I have noticed is this. When they do spray it, there is, of course, the weeds start dying, so they start emitting a lot of carbon dioxide. Fish start to vacate, do a major vacating of shallow water and shallow weeds. And so you start fishing deep open water, deep hard bottom areas. So it will affect the location of the fish temporarily, mm-hmm. And then when the first effects are done, wind action and whatnot will bring oxygen levels back up into those spots, and those fish will move in, and you'll have a short term good effect from it, in that you'll have less weeds, and you'll be able to pinpoint the fish more, and it'll be more catchable, but. Unless you really stay on top of it. Once that stuff gets in a system, it's very difficult to get rid of.
Very difficult to get rid of. And I know Beth Kibble was telling me, who is the organizer this year of the World Championship Muskie Classic, that the Classic and the tournament has taken a look at this and really maybe one of the first tournaments to ask about what could be done to kind of help the situation to alleviate the problem. And I don't know, Leo, you may have some information on that.
A couple of years ago, we discovered milfoil in one of our tournament lakes, and we immediately shut it down. We took it off our schedule. It did not become a tournament lake anymore because we didn't want it spreading to other lakes, other bodies of water. And it could happen very, very easily with just a small piece of milfoil transported to another lake, and all of a sudden we got it two lakes. So we closed that lake down. We did put in another lake, another good lake in the area. But right now, and I'm gonna say this for everybody that's sitting here and for our audience, we are going to be inspecting our boats as they come up from the south, as they're moved from lake to lake. We're going to have people at landings checking boats. So we're preaching to the people to be courteous, be patient. Allow them to look at your boat. Allow them to look at your live well. We just don't want that stuff in our lakes up here. So, well, word of caution, be careful and be patient.
All right. Thanks very much, Patty, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And some more callers online. But let's take another call first from the audience here. Tom in Springstead. Yeah, there's Tom right in front of me. Okay.
It's getting to be the fall of the year quicker than we'd like around here. Normally, we back in the good old days, we would drag suckers. And I quit dragging suckers several years ago because of the catch and release. Is there a decent way to rig a sucker so you can still use it and not hurt the fish?
All right. Well, probably any of these guys could answer it. Leo, you want to take a shot at that? Leo Crowley?
Working in a sports shop a couple of days a week, we sell an awful lot of quickset rigs. And if you use it properly, and I'm talking about hitting the fish right after he picks up your sucker, and especially if you're rigged right on the sucker, you won't hurt that fish. I mean, there's going to be an occasional fish that will die from mortality or stress or whatever that happens when you hook him, especially if he's a big fish. But normally, they're 95% foolproof. You aren't going to hurt that fish.
All right. Thanks very much. And let's go to Julius next in Tishigan. Julius, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. Question on your poisoning of the weeds in the lake. I live on Tishigan Lake for the last 15 years, but I have fished it for 40. Last year, they poisoned the weeds three times in our lake. When they were done, the water is a putrid, smelly green, stinks, weeds floating. It never did clear up. It was even the putrid green ice fishing. Fishing all but stopped. Not only for myself, but there's a hardcore anglers that really pound this lake, and they actually quit. This year, they poisoned it twice, and it's worse than ever. There's big bogs of floating like foam that when a lake turns over in spring, you know how the stuff comes up on top? You can't even get through it with an outboard. So poisoning the milfoil has to have some effect. And like I said, I've never seen the white bass have completely disappeared. You could always first ice fill a sled with white bass. And the last white bass I saw caught out here was the 10th of October last year. And it's not that I don't get any, but every day ice fishing, I'm retired. I walk the ice and nobody has seen any. Hmm. Now, can you tell me what kind of, and the fish smells, the water smells. You pull up an anchor rope and you have to wash your hands with soap and water. They stink so bad.
Well, I tell you what, that's, again, it sort of goes along with what our earlier caller, when she called to ask, well, what are the effects? And Joel, you were kind of talking about those very effects.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, you even see a kind of a, you kind of, you, when you do something, there's a reaction, you know, and when you start spraying, for example, even when I spray my lawn in the summer, you spray it for clover. If you want a real nice lawn, you spray some kind of a weed killer for clover. You'll notice that, oh, you kill the clover all right. But you create another problem. You create a moss problem. You know, so you start, moss starts growing. When you do something like this, there's some kind of a reaction that it's not always good. And a lot of times what happens, too, what he's saying there is, you know, you're getting some kind of a, it may be some outrageous algae bloom that's occurring. It'd be better addressed by somebody who really is a limnologist or really knows more about that style, you know, what's really happening and what are the exact reactions. But it sounds like our friend who's calling there, their lake has got some serious issues there that somebody needs to take a look at. And I'll tell you, we do see even up here, we do see every year we see an algae bloom about this time of the year in a lot of those lakes too. And it seems to be compounded by this kind of stuff. And there's no easy answers to it. And I'll tell you the other thing, the other problem we have too is that Wisconsin has such a variety of lakes. We have so many different bodies of water. You know, we're not just dealing with a couple bodies of water here. We're dealing with, you know, thousands.
More than 10,000.
Yeah, yeah. So when you're talking that many lakes, that's a big job. And I don't know that we really even have enough personnel at our government levels to even address this situation. And it really needs to be. Somebody asked earlier about the fish stocking and the hatcheries down here. You know, I think it's a personal opinion, but I think that with catch and release becoming so popular today in muskie fishing, for example, I think that a lot of that emphasis that originally was on stocking muskies, a lot of that, those dollars and a lot of the emphasis should be repositioned now to really dealing with lake quality, water quality, these invasive species. I think, you know, the bulk of the money, resources, and personnel should be positioned in that direction, because that's where the real problem is. It's not with stocking fish. A lot of these, with the catch and release in muskies being so predominant today, the natural populations of muskies that now exist in these bodies of water are taking pretty good care of themselves. We don't really have a shortage of muskies anywhere. Now, I would argue that we need more fisheries outside of this area to accommodate all the growth in muskie fishing. Mm-hmm. But in this area, we've got lots of muskies. We've got a lot of great natural reproduction in muskies. Natural reproduction in muskies is never superb, but it's good. And those natural strains of muskies, you want to be left alone. A lot of times when you stock muskies, you actually introduce a strain of muskies in those bodies of water that is inferior to the natural strain that's there. I would much rather, as a person, just a personal opinion, I would much rather see all of that money, effort, resources, good personnel be directed towards, let's really deal with this invasive species problem and water quality.
And I guess you'd kind of like to see as much enthusiasm among everybody, fishermen everywhere, for that kind of an approach as we have come to be in terms of catch and release of muskies. It would be great to have that same kind of zeal among everybody, not only fishermen, but everybody else that uses the lake and enjoys and recreates on our more than 10,000 lakes, Minnesota, that we have here in Wisconsin. We'll take some more calls. We're talking today from the headquarters of the World Championship Muskie Classic in Manitouish Waters at the Manitouish Waters Community Center. And our guest, Bill Shearer, founder of the Classic event, Leo Crowley, has fished it for 31 years, a board member, and Joe Booker of Eagle River, Wisconsin, who holds, I said, 5 line class world records. I think it's 7, isn't it, Joe? Yeah, he gets 7 world records of not only muskie, but a variety of fish as well. And, of course, has his own television program, Fishing with Joe Booker, and a lot of other things, too, Muskie Magazine and many, many more. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Please stay with us. Lots more to come. We're talking fishing today, zeroing in a little bit on muskie fishing, but take some other fishing questions as well. And obviously, we've been talking about other things relating to fish. Obviously, fish live in water and live in all of our lakes, I think, in the whole state of Wisconsin. So Eurasian milfoil and other issues certainly are on our minds as well. Today, I should mention, too, that we'll be a little bit later on, we'll be talking with Ben Hobbins. He'll be joining us after our noon break, and he'll be talking about some research he's been doing on some new plastic lures. They're soft lures, but you can't pull them apart. They're pretty much indestructible, and there's some interesting things to talk about, I'm pretty sure, with Ben Hobbins, and he'll be visiting with us afternoon. Right now, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890, and we're still taking questions from the audience. So if you have a question out there, raise your hand, and one of our great people will get to you as quickly as possible. Let's go to Mike in Lone Rock next. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon or morning.
Morning.
Question on the Weedy Lakes. why does not the DNR allow the introduction of hybrid white carp or grass carp or white lemur to take care of this problem?
Missouri's going crazy with that. One of the issues, I can tell you, we've had some issues here in the state with fish that have been brought in to deal with other problems or as a food fish. The carp was as a perfect example of that, but maybe one of the guys, Joe, you want to say something, or Leo, or Bill, chime in.
Well, I've got an
opinion. Leo, go ahead.
I've got an opinion on putting one invasive species or one exotic species against another, because all you're going to do is create another exotic species. So I think that this needs to be taken care of naturally with chemicals. You might kill off your lake for a year or two, but I'll guarantee you it can be restocked and restarted once you've got the problem taken care of. But I don't think bringing another exotic in to take care of a problem is going to work very well.
I just came back about 2 months ago from fishing in Missouri, and those people down to that whole area have a terrible problem, and it's almost every sports broadcaster, you know, over the course of the week will have some pictures of what's happening, and those critters are pretty tough. They break people's noses, arms, and so
forth. You're talking about these carp now.
I'm talking about the carp, yes. And they're very difficult to handle, and they try to get as many as they can out of the lakes.
They jump out of the water pretty high, and they're fairly large, and we've actually had a few deaths, if I'm not mistaken, from people being hit while riding in a boat or riding on a jet ski and actually have been hit, knocked out, and drowned because they were hit by those fish. So I think that's the answer from our experts, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. John in Algoma, I think, is next. John, hi to you.
Hi. It's amazing that this topic has come up on the radio station, and I'm really glad to hear somebody talking about these issues. I have lived in on a lake in Oneida County for 60 years now, and have watched it go through incredible changes over that period of time. I've been fishing since I was about 8 years old. We have a lake association where it's a large lake. It's like Tomahawk on the Minocqua chain. We got all of the what I call neighborhood or shoreline associations that were largely social that were created around the lake to come under an umbrella organization. We all joined together, and we're in the process of doing a comprehensive lake management plan. And I can't emphasize how important it is in dealing with aquatic invasive species that the people on the lake, the people who have concerns about the lake, the people who drive in and drop their boats in the lake, get involved in taking a look at the lake, getting some serious, hard scientific data on water quality, on pollutants in the water. What some people may think is a problem with a plant like Eurasian water milfoil may only be indicative of problems that, as a result of unusual erosion into the lake or the use of phosphorus-based fertilizers adjacent to the lake causing outrageous blooms and that sort of thing. You need to go out and test the quality of the water, and there is a tremendous amount that individual citizens can do if we get organized and work together. We can push and get things done. We have a Sentinel, Lake Sentinels group that has over 40 volunteers who are doing surveys of 17 sectors of the lake three times during the course of the summer to identify exactly where the invasive species are, so that the consultant service group that works for us can go out and officially map it and then deal with it. And we're doing some treatment, but we're also looking into some mechanical removal methodologies, and I hope that the DNR will approve our use of those, because smaller patches of Eurasian water milfoil, for example, can be removed by pulling it. But the problem is how fast you can get the material onto a boat and get it drained out, and that requires a mechanical system. It's not dredging the weeds, it's actually just transporting the weeds up into the boat. The DNR doesn't have enough staff to do this, they don't have enough money to do this, they don't even have the expertise. And I'd suggest that you might want to consider bringing a gentleman by the name of John Scogerbo from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He's over at the Algali Reservoir to talk on your program about what can be done to control invasives, and maybe someone like Ted Ritter, who is the AIS coordinator for Vilas County, who has tremendous experience in organizing community groups around lakes to deal with these problems.
John, I thank you very much for calling, and I think it sounds to me like John and the folks in his area have put together a real community effort, kind of like what you were talking about, Joe, I believe, in a way.
I think that's critical, is that you know, all of us have to get involved, and all of us, it's maybe not the prettiest subject, but I think it's probably the most important subject right now is really dealing with this. And he's absolutely right that we have to get involved from, if you have a body of water that you live on, especially, or you vacation on, you have a vacation home on or cabin or whatever, you need to get involved with a lake association or start one and become, that becomes a strong political group where you can actually, you know, put some pressure on some people, and at the same time start something going, just like this fellow did here, where their community and their lake did. And I think that's going to be one of the answers. And I think we're just all going to have to really start really looking at this real seriously, because obviously from your phone calls you can see that this is a big issue. It's a big issue all over the country, and believe it or not, it's not only here. It's all the way up into Canada. Yeah, and it's all in Canada. It's real. Canada's got a big problem. You know, all of us Americans that drive across the border are dragging the Eurasian milfoil right up there too. Lake of the Woods has got it. You know, French River, you know, Georgian Bay's got it. All of the Great Lakes have got it already. So it's an issue, and it's not going away. And so that's why I say I just like to see from a state level, even, you know, I think this we're you know, our DNR and all of our folks that are, you know, I think the money and the resources need to be focused in that area more than anything else right now. I think that's where we need to go.
Yeah. Thank you again, John, for calling. Appreciate it. Want to give Jim and Hurley a chance. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
I've got a question for you. I've got a place on the Gulf Lodge, and the dam, it fills up in the spring, and you usually lose about 6 feet of water to the fall, and that just about ends ice or fishing until you go to ice fishing. When you talk about all these species and all everything that can grow and ruin a lake, is it easier to maintain or fix or stop all these species that you're on a flowage where you can drain the water right down to the riverbed and use, say, a minimum amount of pesticides or whatever you're going to do, run it through the river and it goes downstream? And I'll take my answer off there.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Leo, you were talking a little bit about this earlier, so let me go to you, Leo Crowley.
Well, I think with the Eurasian water milfoil, once you drained it down and got at it, yeah, that would probably work rather well. But then you need to get rid of everything that's there, because one small, very small piece that's left in that lake will recede and come back to haunt you, so to speak. So draining it down, you just may be passing your problem on farther down. So I guess I wouldn't think that would be the proper way to go. When they get it down as low as you can, and if the water Eurasian water milfoil is exposed, go get it. That's the only thing I can tell you.
Yeah, Joe Booker, you want
to? What's interesting about what our recent caller just asked is I do a lot of fishing in the south in the winter, and a lot of that fishing occurs on reservoirs, flowages. They call them reservoirs down there. And they have all kinds of weed problems down there. Mm-hmm. One of the main management techniques by the Army Corps of Engineers and the state DNR folks there is a 5 to 7 year programmed draw. They call it a drawdown, where they actually every 5 years. In fact, most of the bodies of water I fish in Northwest Florida, for example, every 5 years. This one specific body of water, they will actually schedule a big drawdown. Well, they'll draw the body of water down 15 to 20 feet, and then they'll expose all that littoral zone, that weed zone. They'll expose that, and so it dries up, and then they will treat it, and then they will let the lake naturally fill itself back up. And then every fifth to seventh year, they do it again. Now, that is actually doable with a reservoir, but that doesn't solve the problem in all our natural lakes. And we have a lot more natural lakes up here than reservoirs. So I can see where the caller actually has somewhat of a point, because they are doing this successfully down south. They are doing it successfully. Well, they have a scheduled drawdown. They draw the lake down anywhere from 10, 15, 20 feet, and then they just expose all of that weed. That weed zone becomes totally exposed and is dried up, and then they actually treat it. Or sometimes they even come in with equipment and actually dig it out and just remove it. And then the lake naturally fills itself back up. And then the process is they continue to do it all the time to keep an eye on it. But that's not going to solve the problem with natural lakes.
We're talking today with Bill Shearer, Joe Bucher, and also with Leo Crowley. And we'll be joined by Ben Hobbins coming up after a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, broadcasting from the World Championship Muskie Classic in Manitowish Waters. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're talking fishing today and lakes and lake water and all kinds of things relating to lures and how to catch muskies. And well, we haven't talked about other fish as well, but we could do that too. We're also going to be talking about new lures here and some new research that's going on with soft lures, soft plastic lures. And our guest, Bill Shearer, with us yet. Bill is the founder of the World Championship Muskie Classic, a board member. Joe Bucher of Eagle River, Wisconsin, our guest as well, world champion fisherman, and also joined by Ben Hobbins. Ben has a patent pending on a new type of soft plastic lure that could become permanent in nature, and want to talk with him a little bit about that and certainly answer your questions as we move along as well. And I've already said hello to Bill and to Joe, and so let me say hello to you, Ben Hobbins. Hi, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me on here to talk about our new technology, and I'm honored to be up here with the names here, yourself included in radio. And I understand you're down in the Madison area, so I'm from Madison originally.
I tell you what, your technology is called Ironclad. Tell us a little bit about this technology. I know you worked with the University of Wisconsin, Tim Oswald, in the engineering polymer engineering center on it.
That's right. Yeah, we actually developed this project and started working on a patent about 2 years ago. And I ended up contacting the Weinert School of Entrepreneurship and had some MBA students and undergrads working on this as a business project, and also pulled in the Polymer Engineering Center that Dr. Tim Oswald actually heads up. A couple of my engineers that were in my product development group actually worked for Gander Mountain and fish for the Badger fishing team as well. So we had some good people in there besides myself, being obviously an avid fisherman my whole life, spending a lot of time in the Sugar Lake from my childhood up in a cabin there. So this technology, what it actually does is...
Yeah, what does it do?
It actually allows plastic lures to actually stay on the hook practically anywhere that you would actually take one of these soft plastic lures, even more soft than a regular plastic. And it's virtually impossible to actually rip them in half. You can hook them virtually in any position on the lure, and it will not come off.
That's amazing.
It's hard to believe. It really changes the whole paradigm of fishing soft plastics. And I know for everybody here that's been using these for decades, even just to think about that and the impact it might have for us as fishermen, and also for the environment. There's two things here. Obviously, we've been using for decades these things. People come up from the south, from all parts of the U.S., to fish here in the northern waters. They have been dropping plastics. And these plastics take a long time to decompose. They're on the bottom of our lakes. So this offers a solution on that side, but it also offers fishermen a superior lure and also a lot more pleasure while fishing, because you're not goofing around, you know, trying to re-rig and do everything else. Tournament fishermen are crazy about them because they know they're going to get probably two to three times more casts in over a tournament interval, which means covering more water and probably catching the bigger fish.
Seems to have, as I remember, it takes something like, if you got cold water and dark water, it can take up to 100 years for the plastic to decompose.
Yep.
So it's a long time.
Yep, even more so. Even more so. As soon as it gets out of the range of UVA and UVB lights, there's very little environmental factors that break this down. So, in fact, it'll just settle just underneath the silt. It obviously goes to the bottom of the lake with gravity. Most of these things do sink, and they're made to sink. Though there are floating ones, you'll find them on the shores. I'm sure everybody in here has seen floating plastics, in various locations.
Well, have you produced some lures yet?
We're actually ramping up right now. We've got 7 different lines of plastics for all types of fishing, from little ice fishing, using little micro noodle. We call those micro clads, which will be available. So when you get these, you won't be re-rigging. Your hands will stay warm. You'll just have gloves to take your fish off. But how many people here have frozen their hands countlessly, either, re-rigging their baits or their little noodles, and all the way up to saltwater lure fishing and muskie?
Well, it sounds like an interesting. Is this process going to be available to others eventually, or is it going to only be your company?
Well, our company has the exclusivity and the patent pending, the process and the application. So at this point, we're looking to produce these, obviously, as our company, as our own advantage. Our goal is obviously to get these out to the fishermen. And there's a possibility in the future that this, why not become a platform for all soft bait plastics. We're open to some of those discussions and have been in those.
I really appreciate you being with us today, and we have callers, and we'll get a variety of calls. Some will relate to fishing, some might relate to your lures, some are going to relate to the championship, the event itself, and I know David in Mondovi is online. And David, let's hear from you. Hi, thank you for calling. Good afternoon.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for the panel, most of whom I'm sure support catch and release. On the other hand, I choose sometimes to catch and consume, and I find a significant amount of animosity among muskie fishermen, especially the diehards. When I'm out with my son and we catch a muskie and put it in a live well, and I guess I don't understand the level of animosity that goes along with my right to catch and consume. If other people want to catch and release, that's fine. But I don't see where my right.
Well, you can't catch one and keep it
without getting sworn at or have my boat rushed or I don't get it. So I'll take my answer off the air. But I'd really like to know if your panel supports catch and release, and if they support catch and consume, and if they don't support catching and consuming, if they could advise their people to leave the rest of us alone.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, I haven't kept a muskie myself in many years. At one point, we kept every fish that we caught. 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we kept every one we caught. I think the last one I kept happened to swallow a particularly large lure. That was about 10 years ago, and I had to keep that fish. And they're pretty good eating. They're pretty good eating. I kind of do them a little crab boil and poach them that way and serve them with a little melted butter, and it's going to taste like lobster a little bit. Joe, what about this whole business of catch and release versus, hey, keep one once in a while?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a very interesting subject. You know, what's interesting about that is if you go back to when Leo was talking earlier about the beginnings of this classic, I don't know what the percentage was then, but I think they may have had both a kept and a release division back then. Mm-hmm. They didn't. They always just had a release thing. Well, I remember when the kept division in the Vilas County Muskie Marathon in my early days of guiding in the late 60s, early 70s, where that was the big deal. And there was very few people releasing muskies. And then there was a time when if you released a muskie, people didn't believe you actually even caught it.
Yeah.
You know, so and how far that's come, it's come to a point where this fellow's it's exactly what's going on, is where you're a bad dude if you keep one anymore. And it's a shame, because there is it's legal to keep one.
Yeah.
You know, it's legal to harvest that fish. And at the same time, we've carried a good thing. It could be argued that we have carried a good thing sometimes a little too far, And I am all for it, as most of you know that watch my show or have read, you know, the things that I've written over the years. I am all for catch and release when it comes to muskies. But when one is badly damaged, you know, that's probably not going to survive, and it's of legal size, you're probably better off keeping it. If you're going to keep a muskie, if this our caller here is you know, concerned about the way he's perceived by other anglers, that is not an issue that can be solved here by this panel.
No.
You know, that is something that has been created by the vast majority of muskie anglers and by, you know, the way things have really transpired. However, I will say this, that an angler out there should be able to take some fish home and eat them. And you know, I say it quite often, when I film a walleye episode, for example, I've said this so many times, you know, and my father, who's no longer with me, hopefully he's watching me right here on stage here doing this thing with you folks here today. But my dad had one motto when it came to catch and release. It was catch and release into the grease. And I am not kidding you.
Hey.
My dad was just the opposite of me in that, you know, when he went fishing, everything was about catching something to go home to eat, you know, to take it deep. And so whenever I fish walleyes, I even make it a point, and I talk to, when I'm talking to my audience on TV, I always say, when I see a bass, I catch a nice bass, I think, you know, catching it, thumb it, put it over the side and release it. When I see a walleye, I see a frying pan. You know, right? And most of us, right? I mean, you see a walleye, you see a frying pan. I bought the only walleye I release. I release big walleyes. I release all the big ones I catch, and because they're old, I don't think they're good to eat. I think they're most important fish to put back into a system. But boy, you know, we shouldn't feel bad about taking a few fish home and eating us. And I'll tell you, I don't know about you, but I enjoy a good fish fry as much as the next guy.
Yeah.
And tomorrow, you know, being Friday in Wisconsin, I'm going out for a fish fry. My wife and I are going to visit one of our favorite places up here and then have a fish fry. And I think, you know, catching and keeping fish here and there is a good thing. I would suggest this to our friend listening that did make the call that, you know, one of the things you might want to consider too is, you know, if you love to eat fish, you know, and you're running into this big issue with muskie anglers, one of the things you just might want to consider, and whether you do, it's up to you, and I don't begrudge you one way or the other. But here's one of the things I've always suggested with muskie anglers. Hey, if you're muskie fishing and you catch those accidental pike, northern pike, for example, take them all home and eat them. I mean, when I'm out muskie fishing and a couple of pike hit my bucktail or my jerkbait or whatever, they're going home. That's catch and release into the grease, you know. And we should all be able to do that. If you want to keep 25 crappies and flay them up and have a good time, we should never. It should never be a complete total catch and release fishery. But the musky thing, especially the big fish, I think that's really one of the secrets to the success of what musky fishing is today, is the fact that because we're releasing all these bigger fish, especially the bigger ones, it's one of the secrets to why our sport is remains so. So good, and we have the quality fishery we do today.
We have a group of guys, the International Muskie Association, that fish, and we always have an annual trip in the fall, and we always do a shore lunch, but we're always muskie fishing. So what we do is we catch some fish during the summer, some northern or walleye or some panfish, and we fillet them, and everybody's got to keep some and freeze them, and we bring them up, and we do. That's how we do our shore lunch, and tastes mighty good when it's out on an island somewhere. It's even though they've been caught a few months ago, and thrown in the freezer, they're still mighty tasty fish. You know, I want to get back to Bill Scheer for just a minute, because I wanted to ask Bill. You know, we're in Manitouish waters, and Ray and I will be fishing the Manitouish waters chain tomorrow. And I've got to explain to people listening that we have 16 of the prettiest trophies that you're ever going to see. And Ray and I intend to try and get one of those trophies. I don't know if we'll do it. Probably won't, but we'll try. But not only can people fish in this tournament on the Manitouish chain, but other lakes as well. Isn't that right?
That's true. That's true. They have a selection, and if they would check off the open, they can fish any place they want to. But we'd like to know always when there's a fisherman on the water, And the most important thing is to come back and report to that station again, because we'll stay out there at 11 o'clock at nighttime, which we had to do so at, on occasions, looking for somebody who had forgotten to tell the person that they went someplace else. So we're proud of you people, and your family is likewise. So,
you know, when I was first asked about doing this program, the first thing I did was I went to a search engine and I typed in World Championship Muskie Classic, Boulder Junction, I think I typed in, but immediately your website popped up with all the information about how to enroll, and you could actually, I did it online because it was early, but for those people who might want to still come up and get excited about fishing in this tournament, you can go online and get all the rules and pretty straightforward regulations and rules and learn a little bit more of the locations and everything else, and that's probably a good place to go.
Absolutely. It has all the information.
It has all of the information, or you can just show up in Manitowish Waters at the at the community center, and sign up tomorrow through Saturday noon. You could
right,
fish.
And if you haven't purchased your fishing licenses yet, you can go hook onto DNR and get it right over your computer.
Get it right over your computer. Now, Ben Hobbins, if a muskie, now I made the mistake, the first muskie I ever caught, I made the mistake of trying to handle it like I grabbed it the wrong way, and I wound up, it looked like little razor blade cuts across my hand, the first one I ever caught. And I'm curious as to how these new baits, these new permanent in nature baits would work if a muskie with those sharp teeth clamped down on it.
Yeah, we get a lot of questions about that, and we were out at ICAST, the 50th anniversary show in Las Vegas. And our display that we had out there, and I brought one here today, were these acrylic tubes with some of our soft plastics with dumbbells hanging from them. This one that we have hanging here next to me is the typical worm for bass fishing with a 10-pound dumbbell hanging off the tip of the tail. Now, there's hooks through either end of that actual ironclad bait, and that also shows fishermen what the effect of teeth has actually on the soft plastic. It has no effect. We're not going to claim that it won't ever have some kind of effect for a savage barracuda or the freshwater version of a muskie. You know, eventually there will be some, you know, scathing, but these are also easy to glue with the regular super glues that are out there that are available just for patching up. But otherwise, these lures, you'll be able to catch probably dozens of fish off them before you actually snap your lure off or snap it off on a log or a huge fish. Amazing stuff.
I've got some barracuda, too, in the Caribbean, and they've got sharp teeth. They're kind of like a lot like a muskie, as a matter of fact, when you come right down to it in terms of how they look. And I can remember once doing a little scuba diving in the Caribbean, and there was I saw in the clear water a barracuda about, oh, I don't know, maybe 100 feet away from me.
You're scary
and he
looking.
Was looking at me, and I was looking at her or him, and about this quick, he was about 6 inches from my nose. They're very fast, and muskies are fast too, and they're great fighters, and they're a lot of fun to catch. Have you guys got a story about a fish that you caught or didn't catch, a muskie, one that might have either been funny or sad? I've got so many sad stories, I could go on for 3 hours.
I have one about the Buckatobin Lakes. We used to live on that lake for a number of years. And a fellow from Wausau,
Bill Hayes.
He caught a lot of his big fish on that lake. Well, I was fishing there one night with a couple young boys. They were about 14 and 15 years of age. And we were fishing for walleye. And I had put on a Repola, and I'd thrown out, I knew where there was a little bar out there, and something hit it tremendously hard. So I had this fish, and I was playing this fish, because I had a 6-pound test line on, and going around the boat, all of a sudden, something come in and grabbed that fish behind the neck and took it, and it was another Muskie.
Another muskie.
And when I looked at that fish and saw it coming, I didn't see the head first. I saw the tail. I said, my gosh, you got the world's largest muskie. And I had that fish on. And every time that fish came around the boat and near where that muskie was, he went right smack into the front end. And the young boy up in front said, you know, Mr. Shearer, he said, I can take my net, the net and get him right here because he's coming so close. But we landed the fish. Well, the thing about it was this wasn't a small fish. It wasn't a tremendously big one either, but it was 36 inches long. And that muskie, too, went after him. So.
Amazing. I'll tell one quick one. After fishing all day long on a favorite lake here in northern Wisconsin, and of course not seeing a fish, I wanted to catch a few crappies for shore lunch in the evening, and I, sort of a similar story, I'm pulling in a crappie, and suddenly my line goes the other way, and a big muskie, grabbed it and finally let go, and I reeled it in, and it was like the cartoon. The head of the fish that I had was there, and the entire skeleton was there, but the rest of the crappie was gone, and so was the muskie. Joe, have you got a story to share?
Oh, I've got a lot of them. Yeah, I could write a book on just that. You know, it's maybe someday I will. But one of my favorites from this area, back in my early days of guiding, I was teaching as I always do when I go out in the water with somebody that I've never fished before. One of the first things I try to do is kind of teach them the basic skills of muskie fishing. And one of those basic skills, after when you bring your lure to the boat, you always figure eight, right? So I had one of those guys that he'd figure eight, you know, one out of every four or five casts, and I finally started getting him to figure eight every time he'd bring his lure in. But he'd hold the handle, hold the rod with one hand at the end of the handle, and he was always looking over at me and asking a question and actually answering the question. He was one of those guys just never stopped talking. And I said to him on three different occasions. I remember his first name was Bill. I said, Bill, I says, you better hold on to that rod with both hands when you're doing that figure eight. I says, otherwise, if something hits, you're liable to lose the rod or have, you know, who knows what'll happen. And so I told him three or four times, and sure enough, about, you know, an hour later, here he is doing that one-handed figure eight, holding on to the end of the handle. He's looking back at me, and we're drifting along, and we're on a lake down here called Big Lake. I think that's in your tournament schedule, yeah, Big Lake, right. West, Boulder Junction here. Just anyways, all of a sudden, we're drifting along, and I'm back doing something in the back of the boat, fiddling with the trolling motor. All of a sudden, I hear a, ah! I said, what happened? He says, the rod. It's gone. I said, what rod? He says, your rod.
I want to, since we're down to our last minute, unfortunately, I wanted to get Leo's story too, but I also want to mention Ben Hobbins. You've got a website, and I want that website. What's your website?
We've got several ways to access our website, but you can go to www.lakeresourcesgroup.com. You can go to ironcladlures.com or ironcladtackle.com.
Ironcladlures or ironcladtackle.com. And Joe, I know you've got a great website.
JoeBucher.com.
JoeBucher.com. And of course, we got WisconsinPublicRadio.org if you want to go to Wisconsin Public Radio. And doggone it, Leo, you're going to have to come on again and give us that story because we're out of time. I thank Leo Crowley, who has fished this classic for 31 years, Bill Shearer, the starter of this classic, Joe Bucher, thanks so much for being with us. Ben Hobbins, thanks for being with us as well. I really appreciate it. And thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.